I hope your day is going well. This is Pat, and I'm reading from the Clinton Journal for Friday, April the 17th. From the front page, the county could move by May to address the rise of data centers. Gordon Woods reporting. As the proliferation of large data centers has struck fear into local governments nationwide, the Land Use Committee of DeWitt County Board is looking at developing an ordinance to regulate them locally. Land Use Chairman Buck Carter and member Patrick Ryan recently attended a seminar addressing the data centers given by the United Counties Council of Illinois. Carter said, with so many jurisdictions looking for ways to regulate the centers, he wondered what the future would hold. He said a sentiment expressed to him was the fear a moratorium on data centers could prevent development of a facility the power plant might provide power to in the future. But overall, it brings us to the fact, should we completely ignore this, or should we really be looking at the future down the road, Carter asked. The type of data centers that primarily concerns counties and municipalities is the hyperscale centers commonly developed by companies such as Google and Amazon. These centers use enormous amounts of water to provide cooling for their computers, which often drives those companies' searches for building locations. The fear, and in some cases already the reality, is that the center's use of local water supplies will deplete those sources. Carter said he wasn't sure the matter was urgent, but asked if the county should get ahead of the game when it comes to planning for the centers. Land Use Committee member and County Board Chairman Joe Witt said he felt the current board should work on the problem now before a new board is seated after the November election. Witt said he is recently contacted by a developer who asked what the board's interest might be in housing a data center in the DeWitt County. I told him I had no idea, Witt said. I said there's only one way to find out, and that's to take it before the board. He said if this particular development materialized, the developer would be looking to locate next to a solar energy facility that has already been approved. Witt recommended taking it to the full board for a vote in May. Do we want to start down the road of putting an ordinance together, Witt asked. It would be nice to have it go through the full cycle, the Regional Planning Commission, the Zoning Board of Appeals, and full board before we turn it over and have a completely new set of faces that have to get up to speed on a lot of the same issues. The ordinance would not necessarily ban all data centers from the county, but would regulate the various classifications of the centers. The four types of data centers include edge data centers, which are smaller, distributed facilities located close to end users to minimize latency and support full-time processing for IT and telecommunications. Enterprise data centers, owned and operated by a single organization to support internal IT operations that offer high security and custom solutions, but are typically lower scalability. Co-location facilities, allowing multiple organizations to lease space for power and cooling from third-party provider, which reduces capital expenditure while sharing infrastructure resources. And hyperscale data centers, the massive facilities operated by major cloud providers such as AWS or Google Cloud, designed for unlimited scalability to support cloud services and AI workloads. Solar facility application. County Zoning Administrator Elizabeth Weichel told land use members they should expect a solar energy facility application on April the 29th. Some of those applications we have reviewed in-house, and some of them we have an engineering firm reviewing them, Weichel said. So I went ahead and got an agreement for them, Cummins Engineering, to just review the siting portion of it, just in case you guys wanted them to review it. The cost for the review would be approximately $6,000. Witt pointed out the application would need to go before the board on April the 23rd in order to hold a hearing on April the 29th. "I want to leave it up to you guys," Weichel said. "I did actually do a review of it, and we have caught a few things that we are having them correct." She said one item missing included the road use agreement, and there was a new decommissioning agreement. And also from the front page, Rotary Park dedicated to Joe Taylor. Rotary Park recently was dedicated in memory of former attorney and member of Clinton Rotary for 53 years, Joe Taylor. Taylor passed away in January. DeWitt County Museum to host author Guy Fraker for a special event. The C.H. Moore Homestead and DeWitt County Museum will welcome Lincoln author and historian Guy C. Fraker to the museum's Carriage Barn in May. In addition to publishing two books about Abraham Lincoln and the 8th Judicial Circuit, Fraker has written and spoken extensively about Lincoln, not only in Illinois, but at various other venues around the country. In addition, he was a consultant on the and participant in Abraham Lincoln, Prelude to the Presidency, an award-winning, nationally distributed documentary produced by Will TV, PBS. He is also a co-curator of Prologue to the Presidency, a permanent exhibit at the David Davis Mansion Historic Site in Bloomington. For several years, he was an instructor at Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Illinois. From 2013 to 2017, he served as chairman of Looking for Lincoln, the action arm of the Abraham Lincoln National Heritage Area. Currently, Fraker continues to contribute to a variety of periodicals on a wide range of Lincoln topics. He is co-chairman of the New Salem Committee of the Abraham Lincoln Association, which works with other partners to rejuvenate and revitalize the iconic Lincoln site. In honor of America 250, Fraker will present Lincoln and the Light of the Declaration of Independence. Fraker's original presentation will focus on Abraham Lincoln's lifelong reverence for the document, the men who penned it, and how Lincoln used it as a guiding light through our nation's darkest times. The event will take place at 1:30 p.m. on Sunday, May the 3rd, at the C.H. Moore Homestead and DeWitt County Museum's Carriage Barn, 219 East Woodlawn, in Clinton. This special event is free and open to all who would like to attend. No reservations are necessary. Additional parking will be available in the lot across from the museum. This is one of several America 250 at the Homestead, celebrating 250 years of American history. Events that take place at the museum throughout the year. For information on additional museum events, please call 217-935-6066. That's 217-935-6066. Tree Commission to mark Arbor Day, April the 25th. The Clinton Tree Commission will honor the late Dr. Harold Weinberg on April the 25th at its annual Arbor Day ceremony. The tree planting to recognize the former community leader and optometrist will be held at the Carol McFeeters Thompson Arboretum space located in the 1100 block of East Main Street. In case of rain, the ceremony will be held at Douglas Elementary School, 905 East Main Street. A public reception with the Weinbergs' family and friends will follow immediately after the ceremony in the museum room of the Vespasian Warner Public Library. In comments on the tree dedication for Weinberg, Tree Commission Chairman John Baker said, "Doc Weinberg was a true public servant who made long-lasting contribution to Clinton through his service on local boards and his willingness to help others. We are pleased to honor him with a lasting memorial, a tree that will bring enjoyment and benefits for years to come. Arbor Day is celebrated in the U.S. and many other countries as a recognition of the importance of trees. The first Arbor Day in the U.S. originated in 1872 in Nebraska at the suggestion of J. Sterling Morton, a newspaper editor who served as President Grover Cleveland's Secretary of Agriculture. Clinton and other communities celebrate Arbor Day by planting trees and encouraging youth to learn about the importance of trees. The three Clinton fifth graders will be recognized at the April 21st Clinton City Council meeting for their prize-winning posters of the 2026 Tree Commissioned Arbor Day Poster Contest. We have two obituaries today. The first is Dixie R. Blankenship. Dixie R. Blankenship, 89, of Clinton, passed away at 4:35 p.m. on April the 8th at Lincoln Village in Lincoln. Services will be conducted at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, April the 22nd, at Weldon United Methodist Church in Weldon, with the Reverend Gary Fairchild officiating. Burial will follow at Weldon Cemetery in Weldon. There will be no visitation. Calvert Funeral Home in Clinton is in charge of the arrangements. Our second obituary is Helen Ann Stitz, or Stites, spelled S-T-I-T-E-S, Grand Junction, Colorado. Helen Ann Stites passed away at the age of 99 on April the 9th in Grand Junction, Colorado, surrounded by her family. A private graveside service will be held in Charleston in June, where Helen and Stan will unite for what would have been their 80th anniversaries. Memorials may be directed to the Clinton United Methodist Church or the DeWitt County Museum. And now from the Prairie Doc, Death, Taxes, and Aging Eyes by Deborah Johnston, M.D. Benjamin Franklin famously wrote, "In this world, nothing can be certain except death and taxes." Franklin was a legendary intellect, and it's hard to overstate the impact he had. But I suggest, in addition to that particular quote, one with which I suspect he'd agree. Most of us know him as the Founding Fathers, as the author of Poor Richard's Almanac and the guy who flew kites in lightning storms. Perhaps less famously, Franklin was also an inventor. He is credited with the creation of bifocal lens, reportedly inspired by his frustrations with switching between pairs of glasses. As a woman of a certain age who has needed corrective lenses since childhood, I can well appreciate that frustration and, in turn, that invention. Our eyes are complex organs. In the very front, there is the clear dome of the cornea. Then we have the iris, the colored part of the eye. This is a muscle, and it controls the size of the pupil, the black central hole through which light is allowed to enter. From there, light strikes the lens, which is pulled into different shapes by small muscles around its edge and focused onto the retina in the very back of the eye. Specialized cells in the retina convert light to electricity, and the optic nerve transmits these messages to the brain. When I talk to my middle-aged patients about symptoms they may be having, they frequently volunteer they now need glasses for the first time, or that they have upgraded to those bifocals. They are usually surprised when I reassure them that this is not only normal, but frankly expected. The cells that create the lens lose the ability to repair or replace themselves over time. The lens becomes less flexible. It doesn't change shape as easily, and as that happens, the eye has a harder time focusing up close. Eventually, a person develops presbyopia, an age-related farsightedness. This same process leads to a condition quite familiar to most people, cataracts. As those cells in the lens deteriorate, they become increasingly cloudy. Light has a harder time penetrating, and it may be scattered on the way through instead of sharply focused. People may notice blurry vision, muted colors, glare around lights. They may need brighter light to read and find it very difficult to see at night. By 80, approximately 50% of people either have cataracts or have had cataract surgery. Presbyopia and cataracts may be normal, readily treated part of aging, but you shouldn't neglect those eye exams. As we get older, other eye conditions become more common. Diseases like macular degeneration and glaucoma can be detected by the eye doctor well before they cause symptoms. Since those symptoms include irreversible vision loss, we should all be motivated to make that appointment. Medicine is ever-changing. Research avenues that seem promising turn into dead ends. Dead ends become detours to unexpected and exciting places. Maybe in the future we will have drops or supplements or some other way to keep our eyes young. But for now, nothing can be said to be certain except death, taxes, and presbyopia. Dr. Deborah Johnston is a family medicine physician at Avera Medical Group, Brookings, in Brookings, South Dakota. She serves as one of the Prairie Doc volunteer hosts during its 24th season, providing health education based on science and built on trust. And now from the op-ed page, Zealots Continued, the on-point column by Richard Koritz. Last week's column dealt with the inherent risks of conflict between the U.S. and the Islamic regime of Iran. This week we have seen more evidence of the risk. The world witnessed the decimation of the Iranian military platforms by the U.S. and Israeli air and naval forces. From a military point of view, that campaign was a success for Israel and the U.S. Unfortunately, it was also a success for the Iranian regime that is currently in power. One would think that a nation that has had the bulk of its military destroyed would be forced into negotiations to end the conflict with its opponent. We saw that was not the case in Iran. Iran, the U.S., and Israel agreed to a ceasefire, with the U.S. and Iran to meet in Pakistan to formulate a permanent ceasefire. Iran, by all Western standards, had suffered an enormous military defeat and should be amenable to a reasonable discussion to end the conflict. That was not the case. Iran came with demands that it would govern the Strait of Hormuz and keep its enriched uranium, and the U.S. would compensate Iran for its losses incurred by the bombing. The American delegation appeared to be dumbfounded by the Iranian position and left the negotiating table to return to the U.S. without a permanent peace plan. The U.S. should not have been surprised. From an Eastern philosophical and theological perspective, the Islamic Iranian regime officials were still a viable entity. Even though many of its leaders had been killed by the U.S. and Israeli bombing, there was still a core of Islamic zealots at the head of the Iranian government. The government still controlled the populace. Iran had stopped maritime shipping through Hormuz, and they still had money in the bank. There was no uprising by the Iranian people and no foreign armies on its soil controlling the day-to-day affairs of Iran. From the Islamic zealot position, Iran had stood up to the great Satan, the U.S., and had not been detoured from its mission of maintaining its Islamic state. This week, the U.S. enacted a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz and is enforcing U.S. control of the shipping lanes. Iran seems to have backed down a bit, but still has hundreds of small watercraft capable of placing mines and harassing shipping if they desire to use those forces. The U.S. and Israel certainly have their military assets available to counter that force, but the insurance companies get nervous and won't insure shipping in a war zone. Hence, shipping stops and commerce is negatively affected. That being the case, Iran still believes it is winning until it eventually runs out of money. The only thing that can bring Iran to a diplomatic resolution is military might. The Iranian populace, most of whom are not Islamic zealots, need to essentially revolt against the regime. This is asking a lot of an unarmed populace. Perhaps there are some in the Iranian military who are willing to initiate that revolt from within. Perhaps the Kurds in Iran can be convinced to assist in the military opposition to the regime. It should be noted that the U.S. and Iran were the best of friends after World War II and until the Islamic Revolution occurred in Iran. Today, the Islamic Republic of Iran and the U.S. are blood enemies. It is the people of Iran who will eventually determine our nation's relationship. The Iranian people must decide their own destiny. The U.S. can certainly help to facilitate a positive and working relationship, but it is the Iranian people that must rise up and assert themselves. The U.S. has a strategic interest in curtailing Iran's nuclear program. From an economic standpoint, the U.S. does not need Iranian oil. Peace works for all nations, if only it can be achieved. Richard Corax is an Illinois native, attorney, and former DeWitt County State's Attorney. Illinois Extension offers safe food handler training for volunteer groups. Decatur, with an estimated 1 in 6 people experiencing a foodborne illness each year, food safety skills are important for protecting the public. University of Illinois Extension is offering training for volunteer groups at various locations in DeWitt, Macon, and Piatt counties in May. Serve It Safely, a non-restaurant food handler program, will cover current best practices in food storage, cleaning and sanitation, safe cooking temperatures, and personal hygiene. The training is designed for volunteer organizations serving food, such as service clubs, church groups, and soup kitchens. Volunteers handling food need to practice up-to-date food safety skills for the safety of guests enjoying food or meals, said Caitlin Mellendorf, nutrition and wellness educator. If an organization is unable to attend the in-person training, a self-paced online food handler training is available at go.illinois.edu/fhtraining. There is a $5 fee per person to attend this training. Visit go.illinois.edu/servesafe by the listed registration deadline. And those deadlines are for Monticello, May the 5th, 9 to 11 a.m., Monticello United Methodist Church, 2020 East Washington Street in Monticello, and register by April the 30th. For May the 14th, in Decatur, there's a session at 1:30 to 3:30, First Christian Church, 3350 North MacArthur Road, in Decatur, and the register by May the 12th. In Lane, at the Lane Christian Church, 4794 Lane Street, there is a session on May the 21st from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. Register by May the 18th. Again, the registration is at go.illinois.edu/servesafe or call 217-877-6042. And now in sports, CHS Maroons go 9-4 with the win over Tuscola Warriors. Mark Rogers reporting. The Maroons are are now 9-4 on the season for their win against the Warriors. On April the 9th, the Tuscola Warriors raided the home confines of Clinton Maroons, hoping to capitalize on the Maroons' recent loss. Preston Curtis took the mound for the Maroons and held the Warriors scoreless for 6 innings, supported by a solid team effort. Carter Bostic, filling in at first base, made 3 stunning catches at first and 1 in the second to end the Warriors' hopes in the first 2 innings. Curtis recorded 9 strikeouts during his 6 innings on the mound. While playing great defense, the Maroons were flexing their offensive muscle by scoring 1 run in each of the first 3 innings and then exploding in the 4th inning for 4 more runs to take the 7-0 lead. In the first inning, the Maroons scored 1 run on 2 singles and a walk. The second inning took 3 singles and a walk, while the third run was a home run by Brock Wilson. Then, in the 4th inning, with 2 out, the Maroons unleashed a barrage of hits, a single, 2 doubles, and another home run, this one by Stone Stith. All went well until relief was brought in for Curtis. The Warriors jumped on the new pitcher for 3 runs until the Maroons' second reliever walked in and shut their rally down after only 3 runs. The Maroons came away with a 7-3 win. And the Maroons' offense was led by Wilson and Stith with 1 home run each and doubles by Wilson and Josh Bass. This puts the Maroon at 9-4 overall and 2-0 in the conference play. Lady Maroons shut out Lady Titans 10-0. Mark Rogers reporting. Saturday, April 11th, the Lady Maroons hosted their second opponent of the day. The invaders this time were the Lady Titans of El Paso Gridley High School, another Route 51 foe. The game started with a stalemate. Both teams had a walk and 3 outs. A pitcher's duel ensued. The home team pitcher won out in the second, facing 3 batters and striking them all out. The Lady Maroons seized the opportunity and struck in the bottom of the second with 2 runs on 1 hit. The third inning saw the opposition again go down 1-2-3, and the Lady Maroons struck again with 1 run on 1 hit. The fourth inning had opposition getting a couple of walks on which they failed to capitalize. In the top of the fifth inning, it appeared the Lady Titans had found their footing with a leadoff triple, a walk and a stolen base, but then nothing. 3 straight strikeouts, and the Lady Titans failed to score. The Lady Maroons, on the other hand, were hungry for a win and loaded the fifth inning with 7 runs on 7 hits to win the game 10-0. The fifth inning for the Lady Maroons had 2 singles, 3 doubles, and 2 triples. Hadley Humble and Camel Bass had doubles, with Lainey Brewer and Annalise Thompson providing the triples. And a second Lady Maroons story. The Lady Maroons struggled to score in a 19-1 loss to Hayworth, Mark Rogers reporting. On Saturday, April 11th, the Lady Hornets of Hayworth swarmed in from the north and settled on the Lady Maroons softball field. The Lady Hornets scored first with 4 runs in the first inning on 2 singles, a double, and a triple, as well as some heads-up base running. The Lady Maroons were able to score 1 run in the bottom of the first, but that was where they would stay. The Lady Hornets, however, added 6 in the second, 1 in the fourth, and a game-winning 8 runs in the fifth inning. The Lady Maroons hardly had time to adjust. And a couple items from the History Almanac. In 1985, the U.S. Postal Service unveiled its new 22-cent love stamp. In 1996, Eric and Lyle Menendez were sentenced to life in prison without parole for killing their parents. Please enjoy the rest of your day. Get out into the fresh air if you can, and I'll be back with you again next week. Bye for now.